Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
This all happened very fast. We had a normal sister, you know, that was going to college and had her stuff together. And then the next thing we know, I mean, this all literally happened within a year. Her whole life just, we were just stunned. And she was in Florida and we were in Colorado. So we only heard what she was telling us. You know, we didn't see any of it. And to get control of all of it was super hard being, you know, me and my older sister have kids. We didn't know she was going to just be gone. You know, she wanted to be sober, and she was trying to be sober, and she was, if you ask any of her friends, her whole life, she had her life together.
And the last time I talked to her was February 13th, and she was at a bus stop. Can't remember where she was going. And it was weird. It's like I knew instinctively the next day that something was wrong, or the day after. And more so now, because I know, you know, if you look back and you don't remember every conversation you have with a person, but I remember that conversation. So I started trying to call. All of us agreed. My mom, my sister, and Amanda, we all agreed something was wrong for her. She wasn't talking to anybody. And it was one of those things where you call and you call and you call her cell phone. It just filled up. The voicemail filled up. And then it was dead. That was only about a day and a half probably before that was all done and over with. No way to get a hold of her, and we called hospitals and we called shelters on community information, and we tried all that, and I started calling the police within days, maybe, you know, 24 to 36 hours max, and they wouldn't do anything at all. She's an adult, she's not really a resident here, drug addict, and trying to get through to these people that did not define her. You know, she's somebody's daughter and she's somebody's sister and all of those things. She was a person. She is a person.
On February 17, 2009, 22-year-old Laura Nimbach went missing. According to reports, Laura's last interaction was with a police officer who found her sleeping behind a building near Memorial Park Cemetery, which is located on 49th Street in St. Petersburg, Florida. When the officer came upon her, he informed her about local homeless shelters that she could go to. Laura allegedly told the officer that she had been at a shelter the previous day, but had left for unknown reasons. Laura was in the midst of leaving a highly abusive relationship and was currently without a permanent place to stay. She had been bouncing around from friends' homes to shelters. After this interaction, Laura Nimbach told the officer that she would make her way to another shelter. But after they parted ways, Laura was never seen or heard from again. For about a year prior to her disappearance, Laura had struggled with an opioid addiction. When she went missing, it appeared that officials did not take the family's concerns seriously. Laura was over the age of 18, and as we've heard time and time again, if an adult person wants to disappear, they can. However, this was not the case for Laura. Despite her grappling with a tough addiction, she was close with her family and friends. She was also trying to turn her life around. She was an intelligent woman who dreamed of becoming a nurse. She wanted to make something of herself, and she had the willpower to do it. In the days following her disappearance, Laura was due to make an appearance in court to testify against her abuser, but she never showed up. So what happened to Laura on February 17th, 2009? Did she willingly walk away from the life she knew? Or was she met with a darker fate? I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 163 of The Vanished, Laura Nimbach's story. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Before we get started, I wanted to share some exciting news. You can now listen to new episodes of the show completely ad-free, exclusively on Stitcher Premium. In addition to my ad-free episodes, you can also listen to tons of other ad-free Wondery shows like Dirty John and Dr. Death. Plus, with Stitcher Premium, you'll get access to hundreds of hours of original content, audio documentaries, and exclusive bonus episodes from some of your other favorite podcasts. You can sign up now for a free month of Stitcher Premium by going to stitcherpremium.com/Wondery and using the promo code Wondery. Then, once you've signed up, just download the Stitcher app for iOS or Android and start listening. That's stitcherpremium.com/Wondery and promo code Wondery. Laura was no stranger to struggle. Growing up, the young girl was the product of two people who had their own slew of issues that prevented them from being the supportive parents that they could have been. Her father had a gambling addiction, and her mother lives with mental illness. To get a better understanding of who Laura was, we need to go back to the beginning of her life. Laura was born in Michigan. She lived there with her mother and two older sisters until she was 5 years old. Then, Laura's father fought for custody of the young girl and eventually succeeded. Despite the fact that they no longer lived under the same roof, Laura kept in touch with her family. The sisters would constantly call one another and spend weekends together until both of Laura's older sisters moved to another state. For this episode, we had the opportunity to speak with Laura's sisters, Marilyn and Renee. Here's Marilyn speaking about Laura when they were children after Laura moved in with her father and the events leading up to her disappearance.
We saw her on weekends, and as she got older, I called her. She called us every day almost and talked. She was raised in a private school. She really, really had a lot going for her. She was in college, and she had worked at a very young age and saved up a lot of money and moved down to Florida for some college. She did college in Michigan, and then she moved down to Florida with some friends. She moved back and forth from Florida a couple times. It's been a long time, so I can't really remember all the details. So she had a good savings account, a car, a nice apartment, living off the beach, a really nice life.
Marilyn went on to explain that at some point, Laura told her family that she had gotten into a car accident, and the doctor had prescribed her pain medication, which she unfortunately got addicted to.
She got into a car accident, and the doctor prescribed her OxyContin. She got addicted to it, and things went downhill really fast. Her whole savings account she used, she went to jail for the first time in her life. She came clean to us and told us that she had a problem. You know, we lived in a different state, so it was really hard to know, you know, because she would just call us. So we knew things were changing, but we didn't know how bad. So we went out there and we got her into a rehab. She stayed sober for a while, went back down to Florida, and she was in an abusive relationship with a man named Sean Wheeler. And he beat the crap out of her, almost killed her. She went into the hospital with a ruptured lung, bunch of breathing problems, and overdosed when he beat her up. She got out of the hospital and she had a court date to testify against him. I believe it was the very next day or the day after her disappearance. The very next day after she disappeared. She was supposed to be in court testifying against him. The cops stopped her on the side of the road and she said she was going to a shelter. I don't know if I believe that. I think she was going to her boyfriend's house. But they were split up, and she's never been seen since.
Renee, Laura's other sister, had similar things to say in regards to Laura as a young woman growing up, and what she remembers about the events that transpired before Laura went missing.
She always got all A's and B's. She played volleyball, softball. She loved horses. She had a ton of friends. She went through Catholic school at a point in high school. She was a nanny for the same family her entire high school career. I believe Laura even paid for her schooling to get herself through Catholic high school because her dad had a gambling addiction. And she wanted to stay in the same school. You know, she bought her own car in high school, graduated. She started school to be a nurse at Wayne State in Detroit and then moved to Florida. She always wanted to go to Florida. And she, you know, waitressed and whatever. And we were all really close. And at some point, she kind of dropped off a little bit. And I didn't think too much of it. You know, she's 21, you know, or whatnot, 22. Obviously, she's got her own life going on. She's living in Florida, she's living on the beach, she's having fun with her friends, she's going to school. But we always talked prior to that a lot. She would come out and visit a lot. She's my three older kids' godmother. I guess in 2008, she called and said she, you know, was addicted to these pills and she was scared and she wanted help. And Laura was never, like, she wasn't the party girl in school. She was the good girl. She didn't date boys because she wanted to get through school and keep focus. And I'm sure she partied, you know, when she was in Florida. And anyways, she had gotten in a car accident, I don't know, 6 months to a year prior to that. And, you know, was prescribed Oxycontin, whatever, oxycodone. And she was a waitress. And then I guess a customer gave her something stronger and with pain clinics down there and whatnot. And that was essentially what she was on then. But it had developed into a problem. She went back to Michigan to go to rehab. And she stayed with her dad. And that girl, Amanda, her friend, was helping out with that as far as giving her a place to stay and just talking to her and whatnot. She left rehab. She didn't stay in rehab. It didn't last long. A couple of weeks to a month. She stayed in Michigan and she went back down to Florida. She was dating that Sean Wheeler guy. We talked here and there, but she wasn't staying sober. The day before Thanksgiving in 2008, I got a phone call at 3 a.m. that she was in the hospital. She was in a coma. She had overdosed. I think I was told that she attempted suicide, and that's kind of what I had the outlook on, but I can't remember, you know, I don't know if that was Laura's version or not. I sort of feel like it was. So I flew out a couple of days later and went down to Florida with her to be with her. The doctors at the time had said she was in complete organ failure, and they said that she had more drugs in their system that they had imagined, but she was up and at it again within days. In that short amount of time, Laura actually got in legal trouble. She was messed up on these things pretty bad around whatever she was on. And she, I don't know if you've seen pictures of her, but she's quite beautiful. She lost a ton of weight and she got arrested once, but she was violent with the police officer, kicked his window out like crazy, lost her mind.
It appears as though once Laura got addicted to OxyContin, her behavior and mentality drastically shifted. Renee previously mentioned Laura's friend, Amanda. Amanda and Laura had been friends since they went to high school together back in Michigan. Amanda's family had often taken Laura in, and she would spend holidays with them because Laura's father was not very present. Amanda's family became like family to Laura.
My family was like the stable family in her life. She didn't have, even though she was very close with her sisters, she didn't have any kind of stable people here. So she would stay, you know, at my mom's house when we were still in high school together. If she needed to use a computer or go to the library or whatever, my mom or I, we would go get her and she could come over. She would go to Christmas and holidays with us to my family's house. So everybody just expected her to be there for my family. Her dad is a gambling addict. Would leave her home for days at a time with no transportation or no ability to like do stuff. And he got Social Security. And so in turn, Laura got Social Security, you know, because she was the child of somebody who did. But he would still make her buy all of her. She'd have to buy tampons. She started working at 12 so she could buy tampons because he wouldn't even buy them for her.
Amanda had moved to Florida before Laura. Having a friend to lean on while making a big move to a different state made the transition that much easier.
In January of 2005, I moved to Florida and something happened where her dad kicked her out of the house and she ended up living at my mom's house for a while with my mom when I wasn't even there. So Laura was like a sister to me, you know. I don't exactly know what year Laura moved down because I'm very bad at dates. But so I was in Florida in 05 and Laura, at some point, I think in the springtime, maybe she was in an abusive relationship and eventually she ended up moving down because she was afraid of Nick. She had I don't know if she got a broken cheekbone or what, but he like slammed her head into the toilet. It was terrible. It was very physically abusive. And so she left Michigan and she moved down there with us, with me and my roommate in Clearwater, Florida. We lived together for a while. You know, it was good. She's always worked in restaurant settings. And so Laura lived with us for a while. She was doing really good. She was going to school. Actually, she went to Wayne State for nursing after high school. Started that and she was doing really good. When she got down to Florida, it was really discouraging to her because that was the time when nursing programs had like year or two long wait lists. And especially because she wasn't in Florida to get your residency for school, it takes a long time and you have to have taxes, you have to have all kinds of documentation if you're under the age of 24, which we were. So she was really discouraged by that. And she ended up going to checking out this ultrasound tech school and doing that ultimately.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. We asked Amanda if she had any idea as to when Laura started down a spiral of addiction versus just using drugs for recreation.
I think she always dabbled in it. She experimented. We smoked pot when we were in 10th grade. I think that she continued to experiment. plus a history of trauma with that trauma of like domestic violence and working in restaurants with people, you know, restaurants are wild. People use a lot of drugs there and it's pretty socially acceptable. And I think that not having a lot of guidance, people loved her, but I think that because she didn't have somebody who she had with her who could see what was actually going on and not just listen to what she said, you know what I mean? She didn't have a lot of people to call her out on her stuff. So I think that, you know, and to like help her confront, hey, maybe you're getting in too far or whatever.
Eventually, Amanda noticed that Laura's behavior was changing. At the time, she wasn't sure what was going on, but eventually she figured out that this had to do with substance abuse. She knew that once she got to Florida, that Laura had begun experimenting with other things, but she didn't realize that it was becoming an addiction.
Around that time, she started acting kind of erratic and would sometimes be very crabby for no reason. She didn't outwardly admit that she was using, and I didn't know that, but in retrospect, she was definitely using and going into withdrawals probably. You know, she was still Laura, though. She was really funny. She'd be so funny. She was really kind.
I was curious to know when the last time Amanda saw Laura. And it turns out the last time the pair were together, Amanda was attempting to get help for Laura.
I realized what was going on, and I talked to her about it. She told her sisters that she was using at that point. And at that point, I think she was using about 10 oxys per day, a lot of opiates, and just really acting very erratic, like very erratic. So we talked about it. She told her sisters. I helped her figure out where she could go to rehab. She went to, I think it was called Harbor Oaks in Hudson, Florida, for a detox. So I only know what she said, and she said she was released to leave after 3 days. I don't know if that's necessarily if she left AMA, but me and my mom found a way for her to go, a clinic for her to get Suboxone from in Livonia so she could come here. She agreed she wanted to stay with us. Whatever, we would figure out the rest later, because she said she wanted to get, you know, she wanted to stop using. She came up here, we drove up, we saw her mom on the way. It was pretty nice. And we got here, I let her use my car. She went to her dad's house. We found out later that she had taken some medicine that had a warning label on it that had that you might get dizzy or whatever. And so she thought that it could be something that would be like a narcotic or something, but it was actually a diuretic. And so she was like acting really crazy, like assaultive. She was just being crazy, like a bar fight kind of thing. And so at that point, my mom was like, you can't be here, Laura. I love you, but you cannot be here. Because this is too much. So she went to her dad's house. She stayed there for 2 days. She stole a couple thousand dollars from him. And she took a bus home to Florida for a plane. Some way she ended up getting home. So that was the last time I saw her.
Finally, towards the end of our conversation with Amanda, we asked her what she thinks happened to Laura. Over time, many theories have been tossed around about what may have happened to her. Some believe that she's no longer with us. Others think she was trafficked. And some think the police are involved because they were the last to see her. Or maybe she walked away from everyone she knew because she was ashamed of the path she had gone down.
It could be anything. Who knows? She was using at a quantity that was very high months prior before she even went into this tailspin. And that was when she was still functioning as a mostly responsible adult. So once she got fully into the life, who knows? Because she was erratic and she was violent. She could be violent. You know, she wasn't always violent, but she She was absolutely very aggressive. And so she could have gotten in a fight. She could have gotten trafficked. Who knows? And it's so sad.
It's not uncommon to share more information about your life with your closest friends instead of your family. Laura was extremely close to her sisters, but there was also a physical distance that they had between them from an early age, and some things you just don't want to tell your family about. When we spoke with Marilyn, we inquired about Laura's drug use and what Laura had told her about it.
She was pretty private when it came to the addiction, but basically she switched from using what the doctor gave her to drug dealers, and Sean Wheeler, her boyfriend, was a drug dealer. And I know that's where she got a lot of her drugs. When she came clean to us, she was, you know, very emotional, crying, and said, "I never saw it coming. I was taking them." And then the next thing that she said she knew, she was snorting them, breaking them up and snorting them. Some of my family suffers from addiction, but it didn't mean she wasn't a person. And back then, addiction was a look down on a little more than it is today. It's a little more accepting in today's society. You know, this all happened very fast. We had a normal sister that was going to college and had her stuff together. And then the next thing we know, I mean, this all literally happened within a year. Her whole life just, we were just stunned. And this happened, and she was in Florida, and we were in Colorado. So we only heard what she was telling us. You know, we didn't see any of it. And to get control of all of it was super hard, being, you know, me and my older sister have kids. And we didn't know she was going to just be gone. You know, she wanted to be sober, and she was trying to be sober. And she was, if you ask any of her friends, her whole life, she had her life together.
Renee mentioned earlier that Laura had overdosed and things were not looking good for her. But Laura was able to rebound from that. After that happened, her family made a trip to Florida. The days that Renee spent with Laura would end up being the last moments she got to spend with her little sister. The things that Laura shared with Renee were heartbreaking, but 10 years later, Renee still cherishes those final moments they spent together.
We went down there, and the story I was given by Laura, what she told me, was that the boyfriend beat the crap out of her. Sean Wheeler was like beating her, to the point outside in front of people that they called the cops, smashing her head into the sidewalk. They arrested him, and she took his duffel bag full of drugs and did a bunch of them. Maybe it was my assumption that she was just trying to kill herself, whatever it was her way of dealing with. Laura was such a good kid and didn't mess up. The whole fear with her was always, when she got herself in this bit of trouble, was the shame associated with it, you know, like, would she be able to come back from that? She was always so hard on herself and had so many expectations of herself. Everything has to be perfect all the time. And so it's not unrealistic for me to believe that she would have tried to kill herself for a guy beating her up, literally, because she would not want people to know that. And plus, she wasn't in her right mind if she was doing that stuff. That happened. I went down there, and we spent the last 5 wonderful days together, for basically being sick and emotional and learning a lot and talking a lot about why and what. So that was November. So we packed her up, packed all her storage up, got all her stuff out of her house that she was living at. And yeah, our mom lived in Kentucky at the time. She flew down as well and met us down there and packed her up. She went back to Kentucky with my mom. We talked every day, and she was sober for those 3 months. She went back to Florida. She had court for this domestic violence case, and she went down there, and she didn't really have anywhere to stay, but for some reason, it wasn't really a huge concern. She, you know, she had a plan. Our cousin lived down there. That's who we stayed with before, and she did go see my cousin, and, you know, she was just like, well, I'm going to stay in this women's shelter until she got a job or whatnot. I never got the feeling that she was going to stay there. I know she wanted to go to court and get that stuff figured out with him. And her own stuff. She was on bond, so she had to figure out her own stuff. So I know there was things she didn't tell us. You know, in those 5 days that I spent with her, you know, she always wanted to feel like she could stand on her own. That's the thing. Like, the car accident thing is, I don't want to burden anybody. You know, she didn't feel a part of our family, which I never knew. And her father and our mother, it was so toxic throughout Laura's entire life. And they never stopped attacking each other, you know, verbally and through Laura and to Laura. It messed with her so bad. She didn't feel loved. She didn't feel like she belonged anywhere. Everybody was focused on the other parent instead of her. She just kind of learned to survive and be what everybody expected her to be, which is really sad. I'm so grateful for that time. It was so heart-wrenching to sit there and just learn how much she suffered. You know, we never knew. And just how horrible. Her dad was a gambling addict and he was never there and didn't know anything about raising a child. And I don't want to say neglectful in the way of like she didn't eat and whatever, although that might be the case too, but neglectful in the way that he just didn't know how to nurture her in any way. She didn't spend as much time as probably needed with her mom. And then, you know, when it was, he never stopped bad talking my mom, and my mom probably never stopped bad talking him. She lived according to what everybody else expected and never felt loved. But you would have never known it. She just had her shit sewed together all the time. I could see her totally getting involved in something way over her head in any capacity. I hate so much. I do not want her to be defined by this, but it is, because in a way it made her who something she wasn't, you know. You don't know the depths people will go to for that. And it's part of the reason we don't have any of these answers. So although I don't want to label her, it's there, you know, it is part of what it is. So yeah, there's a million thoughts that go through all of our heads. And my mom was convinced for a long time that the police were involved. And I, you know, sometimes I think that as well, that something happened and they screwed up. So they covered something up, sort of get why they're adamant about not looking for her in a city that big with that many homeless and people and drug addicts. But not looking into Sean really bothered me. And we've never had contact with him.
According to Laura's family, she spoke with them constantly. Given the fact that they lived in different states, I was curious to find out when they noticed that Laura was missing.
We talked every day. And she was staying sober and she was doing well, considering. And the last time I talked to her was February 13th, and she was at a bus stop. And it was weird. It's like I knew instinctively the next day that something was wrong, or the day after. And more so now, because I know, you know, if you look back and you don't remember every conversation you have with a person, but I remember that conversation. All of us agreed. My mom, my sister, and Amanda, we all agreed something was wrong for her. She wasn't talking to anybody. And it was one of those things where you call and you call and you call her cell phone. And then it just filled up. The voicemail filled up. That was only about a day and a half probably before that was all done and over with. No way to get a hold of her. And we called hospitals and we called shelters on community information. And we tried all that. And I started calling the police within days, maybe, you know, 24 to 36 hours max. And they wouldn't do anything at all. She's an adult. She's not really a resident here, but she has a record. She's a drug addict, and trying to get through to these people that did not define her. You know, she's somebody's daughter and she's somebody's sister and all of those things. She was a person. She is a person. She's a person that had a very short-lived drug addiction that by far did not define her. Got nowhere with these people. They refused to look for her and they refused to take a missing persons report. So she was missing for 6 weeks before they filed an official missing persons report on her. I actually had to call the FBI to get them to file a report called NamUs. And they called the Pinellas County police and they just weren't cooperative or helpful or nice even to us. And like I said, it was just an endless fight to try to get them to help at all. But apparently, she was seen twice by the police. So the last time she was seen alive was after we talked to her, but it was by them. Some of the time she was actually seen with Sean Wheeler in his car by a police officer. This was just days before his court case for domestic violence against her, for assault. And then she was seen February 17th sleeping behind a building And so that was kind of their answer. Well, she's homeless, so, you know, we can't track all the homeless people here. And that's that. But, you know, it's not that hard to contact us. And something was wrong in shelters, like you make phone calls. And why did she leave the shelter that she was staying in? She was staying in a women's shelter to begin with. So there's all of those things. And they wouldn't answer. And I kept asking them, you know, to go, Sean had a record and go talk to him. And all they kept saying is, he's not involved. He's not involved. He's not involved.
It seems suspicious that Laura was seen with Sean Wheeler before she went missing. She was seen at a later time without him, but this man was already known to be violent against her. Could he have somehow been involved in her disappearance? I wondered how closely the police looked at him in regards to this case. According to Renee, after asking countless times, officials finally looked into Sean Wheeler.
Finally, they say that they went and talked to him, and that was their answer. He didn't have any explanation, and he's not involved, and that was that. We did the best we can. I had no money after going out there. But we, meaning my sister and I and Amanda, and as much as my mom could help, you know, searched for her from here. Amanda really played a big part in a lot of this. We had flyers made and distributed there by people. And we had a Facebook, a little bit of a Facebook presence. I mean, it was enough where, you know, obviously there was no media coverage, local media coverage on her being missing, but we had, Facebook was fairly new then. You know, this was February of 2009, March of 2009. We had news stories covering the story of Laura based on how much Facebook coverage we had, you know, how many shares or whatnot. People, you know, strangers were helping, were passing out flyers and posting flyers. And we would get a few random phone calls here and there that she was seen. This was in the Tent City in Clearwater or St. Pete. You know, somebody once said they saw her at the bus stop. And I don't know if the police ever followed up on any of it. We weren't there to follow up. And I don't know if they ever did. They would get these tips or we'd tell them. And they didn't really want to go around chasing every tip they had. This is so hard for us to believe. There's so many thoughts go through your head of what could have happened and her thought process. If her shame would keep her out there and she just wasn't calling because she fell off again or, you know, relapsed or something and how bad it got. But there came a point where it just couldn't be that. Was it Sean? Did something happen? And did she freak out? Did she OD? Did somebody hide it? You know, my assumption was, she wasn't staying on pills at that point, just like most opiate users don't anymore. They progress.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. Opioid addiction and drug abuse of that nature is considered an epidemic. According to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, between 21 and 29% of individuals prescribed an opioid for chronic pain abuse them. To get a better understanding of opioid addiction, we contacted an opioid expert, Mark Perino.
My name is Mark Perino. I serve as the president of the American Association for the Treatment of Opioid Dependence. And that's the association that has 30 state chapters in the country and represents over 1,000 of the outpatient OTPs. I founded the organization in 1984. Predominantly in the 70s and 80s, it was driven by heroin, not prescription opioids. And at that time, you had, let's say, ethnographically, what was called a third white, a third Latino, a third African American. Now, when you talk about the patient population in the opioid treatment programs, it's, I'd say, 75% white, and then you have a sort of balance of Latino and African American. The dominant difference changed clearly in the 1990s, mid to late 1990s. As a greater number of patients were being admitted with predominant addiction to prescription opioids. And we began a study in 2005, which continues to the present time, with about 110,000 patients completing surveys upon admission. So we've learned a great deal about this. And now you do see changes in drug using characteristics. But I would say the profound switch really hits in around 2000 to 2005, and the two dominant factors which were captured in the study. The first is that about 45% of new patient admissions indicate that they are now addicted to prescription opioid. What is unique is that of that group, of that 45%, 30% were indicating that they were injecting the prescription opioid. And we captured that first trend data about 2010. And that really was the canary in the mine shaft.
We wanted to know how and why opioids of any kind have the effect that they do on people, and if addiction is an immediate occurrence when taking such a drug.
Typically, heroin gets into the brain at a much faster pace than OxyContin would, or an OxyContin-related product, and especially if you inject it. If you inject heroin, it gets to the brain within 10 seconds, and that's what produces typically the narcotizing effect, especially for opiate-naive people. You can describe it almost as if it would be like a pharmacologic hammer blow to the brain. It's powerful, and it gets to the brain very quickly. Fentanyl and carfentanyl, even more of a threat. It has greater power. It is more concentrated, even compared to heroin. So fentanyl, as an example, carfentanil have what's called like a morphine equivalency rate. It's the equation, the ratio used is it's 50 times more powerful than heroin. Not everyone who takes opioids is going to become either dependent on them or addicted to them. That is a fallacy. So ultimately, there are a number of elements. One element is how long you're going to be taking the opioid. Now, if you are taking an opioid, even one prescribed by a physician through legitimate medical means, depending on the opioid, its power, the frequency of its daily use, its use over time, let's say 30 days, 60 days, you're going to become dependent. So not addicted, but dependent, meaning you're physically needing that medication. Dependence is easily described as if you discontinue the medication abruptly, you will feel some withdrawal effect. Once again, the effect of the withdrawal is entirely dependent on what the opiate is, how much you were taking per day, and what was the prolonged period of time. You will feel something. Now, again, it depends on the individual. You will feel either irritation, or you will feel you're not going to sleep as soundly for several days. The more progressive signs of withdrawal could be muscle cramping, nausea, throwing up, headaches, chills. And that's dependency producing. What makes the leap from dependence to addiction is behavior. You start now craving more. You're increasing your use markedly. If you're legitimately getting it through physician prescriptions, you're seeing more physicians until that catches up to you. If the doctor is checking in on the prescription drug monitoring database. But ultimately, the addiction is drug-seeking behavior. You stop going to work. It starts to affect your life. People who are close to you, around you, start noticing there's a difference in behavior and attitude. You're taking an increasing amount of drug. And also, there's a real giveaway when you go from dependence to addiction. You change the route of transmission. Let's say you're taking 4 Oxycontin per day. Well, then you start increasing as you're going to 6, 7, 8, and that's not doing it. So you start crushing it, or you're snorting it, or you're smoking it. And then finally, the most efficient way to get a drug in the system is through intravenous use. That is generally the trajectory as you go from dependence to addiction, that cycle of drug use, that frequency, and the changing of the route of administration. And of course, that's when you're becoming dysfunctional. That is a real distinct difference between dependence and addiction. When you get to the point of addiction, you're not really functioning. You're chasing that drug, and you'll do whatever you have to do. Dependence may be you're going back to your doctor. Addiction is you're breaking into the pharmacy. You will steal, you will do whatever it is to procure that drug.
Mark gave a great comparison on how becoming addicted is a gradual process and not something that happens instantaneously.
And I guess the way to look at this is alcohol use. It happens gradually. This is not an instant process. So you have more people who are alcohol dependent and alcoholic than are opiate addicted, just to be clear, in this country, even with this epidemic. And so you can ask the same question of how come a person is drinking increasing amounts, but they're not recognizing they have a problem. So you get into the area, I'm coping, I'm adapting, I'm really okay, I don't have a problem. It's not the case, but you're dealing with the subjective experience of I'm not realistically going to take a look at what I'm doing. Is my use or abuse of alcohol or a drug affecting my life? So the answer can be like the whole issue of, well, you're a functioning alcoholic. You're going to work. You're taking care of things. You're not missing day. You're not disrupting family events, but you are drinking more than you should be. And then you can say sometimes you get into objective lab tests. You go to your doctor. You get an annual physical and liver enzymes are elevated. Something is showing physically. Although there's no outward behavioral sign that something is wrong. So the answer to the question is people are adapting. We're very good at coming up with lots of complex rationalizations. Just to be clear, and I'm not saying they're equivalent, but cigarette smoking is a good example. Everyone knows by now that smoking a cigarette is dangerous to your health. There's no question about it. Everybody knows. And the government has put clear markings on all cigarette packs. Still, people go and smoke a pack of cigarettes a day. Someone is consciously aware they are engaged in behavior that is clearly detrimental to their health. It doesn't stop. Like the alcoholic who says, you know what, I'm doing okay. Yeah, I'm drinking more than I should, but I'm still okay. The same applies to somebody who's crossing from dependence on opioids to addiction. I'm okay. It's only when something really, really vital happens. I spent 18 years of my professional life working in a methadone treatment program in New York City. Always the admission issues would be, especially for new admissions, I just got arrested. I don't want to go through that again. It's like an incredible wake-up call. And I just spent, 48 hours in a jail cell going through withdrawal. I can't do that. Or I'm frightened. I don't want to get hepatitis. I don't want to get HIV. I can't put myself in that danger. Or my friend who was using drugs with me died. I don't want to die. Or my wife just threw me out of the house. Or my parents threw me out of the house. Or I just got fired from my job. In other words, the shocking piece is when external reality comes in and says, whether you think you've got a problem or not, you're losing your job. You're losing a relationship. You've alienated your family. You've crossed the threshold into criminal matters. These are factors that typically motivate the patient to enter treatment and to recognize they have a serious problem.
One thing that Mark brought up is the CDC guidelines for pain management, and that these guidelines are often not followed. Laura had said she became addicted after being prescribed medication following an accident. People from all different backgrounds have found themselves in similar situations after being prescribed medication following an accident, injury, or surgery.
The CDC guidelines for pain management is probably the most recent one that's come out. And they're guidelines, they're sort of recommendations. The question is how many physicians who are practicing and prescribing, how many are aware of those guidelines? How many have actually read them, digested them, and followed them? That's a separate question. And I don't think anyone's come up with an analysis of that at this time. But the CDC guidelines were promulgated in recognition that a lot of physicians were not aware of what they were really doing. And there's something else that was a pain management specialist by the name of Howard Hite. And he's very smart, and he's been around a long time. And he said an interesting thing to me many years ago, which is it takes a physician about 2 minutes to rewrite a new prescription or to refill a prescription. It takes about 20 minutes to explain to the patient why he's not. It becomes a time management issue for the practitioner. Anyway, the point I'm making is that the reason this is so complex is because you have a lot of moving parts. The patient's own subjective experience, am I okay? No, you're not okay, but I don't want to recognize it. Or the physician, the practitioner, am I asking the right questions? Generally not. Am I following the patient up closely? No, generally. Am I educating the patient about the good and the bad? What are the things to look for? No, generally. You need many things to create this long-term problem. And just to be clear, when a person who has either a physical problem, which causes pain, or an emotional problem, and they find just the right drug, and that could include alcohol, that really relieves that, that's a bad day for that human being, because that person is going to go right to that. I mean, it's like the age-old issue. How come some people like alcohol but don't like drugs? How come there are some people who like various drugs but don't want to drink? It depends on how their brain is receptive. And the brain is a highly differentiated organ. So it really does depend on, like that classic issue that doctors now ask. Tell me about your drug use, alcohol use history. Tell me about anybody in your family, parents, siblings, who had a drug abuse history. Or if you can go back to grandparents, that's sort of like family tree stuff. The more the patient really does know, I mean, there's almost always something where somebody says, yeah, my aunt had a big problem. Or, my father or my mother, somebody. Almost always, you get into that sort of like family tree building exercise, you're going to find something. You can argue, and some researchers have made this point in articles, that it's called a predisposed brain. That if there are histories of gambling, it is possible that it sets up genetically the individual. It doesn't mean you will become. It means you are preconditioned. It's that ultimately you are susceptible to it.
Some people tend to forget that we are all human, and humans are susceptible to mistakes and missteps in their lives. It's easy to judge and cast a stone at a person that we don't know, but that doesn't make it right. Laura Nimbach, no matter what choices she made in her life, was still a daughter, a sister, an aunt, and a friend. She was loved by many people. Mark Perino is no stranger to drug addiction. To know about it and learn it is his profession. Towards the end of our conversation, we asked Mark what he believed is the biggest fallacy surrounding those with drug addiction.
I think probably the biggest is that the people who become either dependent or addicted are these sort of like losers or people who are thieves and they're liars and they don't care about anyone and they're just sort of animals. It's simply not true. Many people have great sensitivity. They've drifted into addiction. They've made a series of really bad choices. And while some may have real sociopathy and be liars and do everything they can to get a drug, they're people. They're human beings. They belong to someone at some time. They're someone's neighbors or children. They're sometimes parents. In other words, there's still a humanity to them. And their use of drugs may compromise that. But I believe that humanity stays within them. I spent, as I said, 18 years of my life working in an outpatient drug treatment program. I found that out continually. While I was surprised by it in the first year or so, I got accustomed to it. And there's always a way to reach someone. It may take time, may take a great deal of patience. But I think the greatest misconception, hence the stigma, is that if they use opiates or they're addicted to them, they're fundamentally different. Don't trust them. They're going to steal from you. They're no good. They have no principles. They're hateful. It may be true of some. It is overly simplistic.
Laura's family has always felt that her case was ignored by law enforcement because she was viewed as just another addict. Marilyn told us that the lack of communication from law enforcement has continued to be a source of frustration for them.
You know, the detectives never call us, and I don't think I've gotten a call from a detective in years. And even when she first went missing, they didn't really seem to care. It took us weeks just to get a missing persons report filed for her because they wouldn't file one.
We contacted the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office, but they declined to comment on Laura's case. Laura's absence has affected her family greatly. They're constantly trying to figure out where she is and what happened to her.
You run every imaginable scenario through your brain of what could have happened. And, you know, did she suffer? And, you know, the not answers and the all of those things. And I just become completely submerged and obsessed with those things. And then I just go in the same circles. I never gain any more answers from anything. And it's really frustrating.
Renee longs to find answers as to what happened to her baby sister. This whole situation has opened her eyes to the stigmas that those who have addictions face, especially when it comes to them going missing.
I always want to do something in honor of her, you know, of course, and whether that's missing people. I think it gave me this soft spot for, gave me this passion against opiates and against pills, and gave me a soft spot towards addicts because we don't know, and missing people, like, you, I don't know, these families that are out there that just, you get blown off because there's assumptions made. And I guess if you have an issue, if you have a mental health issue or an addiction issue, the same thing, that you don't deserve to have a resting place.
So what happened to Laura Nimbach on February 17th, 2009? Despite search efforts, the family has not come up with any solid leads as to what happened to the 22-year-old. The clues in this case are sparse. We know that Laura had returned to Florida after being clean for several months. She was due to appear in court to testify against her abuser, and she also had legal matters of her own to take care of. The police have said that she spoke to an officer on the day of her disappearance. The officer that found her sleeping behind a building reported that Laura had said she had left an abusive relationship and that she had been staying in a domestic violence shelter, but had left the day prior. She told the officer that she was going to go to another shelter, but there's no evidence that she ever made it to another one, and no one has seen or heard from Laura since. The police have also stated that they had seen her days earlier in a car with her abusive ex-boyfriend, Sean. We don't know what the police have or have not done in this case because they haven't been very open with Laura's family, and they declined to speak with us or release any further information about their investigation. Over the last 10 years, many theories have come up as to what could have happened. Did she leave on her own? Was she killed by her abusive ex-boyfriend so she couldn't appear in court? Were the police somehow involved, since they were the last ones to see her? Could she have been trafficked? I think the fact that so much time passed since Laura was last seen and when she was actually considered a missing person, that crucial window of time to investigate was already closed. Important evidence that could have been gathered was now lost. We may never find enough evidence to figure out what really happened to Laura, but her family will never stop looking. At the time of her disappearance, Laura was 5'5" tall and around 105 pounds. Laura had her hair dyed blonde, but it's naturally light brown. Some distinguishing features include a lower back tattoo of a pink flower, with a tribal design and her initials LN on her left wrist. At the time of her disappearance, she also had her nose, upper left side of her lip, tongue, and belly button pierced. If you have any information about the disappearance of Laura Nimbach, please call the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office at 727-582-6333.
Laura wasn't just just drug addict on the street. Laura had a whole life and stayed in contact with us. Even during her drug use, she stayed in contact with us. She called all the time. She came and visited me. I mean, she was close to her family. Before she went missing, she called us. I mean, I had talked to her. And she said she was going to go to a shelter. Just all of it doesn't add up. I mean, she was supposed to go testify against this boyfriend. No one's really looked into the boyfriend a lot, and she just disappears before she's supposed to testify. And then, you know, the cops said that they were the last one to see her and talk to her, but anytime we try to get any information on who the cop was and the report, no one will give it to us.
My life fell apart when Laura went missing. I was obsessed with finding her, and then nothing was happening, and it was awful, you know, and I didn't find a balance with it. I didn't feel like I was doing anything productive. There's a million things I should have done, and I never even thought of doing, and there's so much regret there, and then, you know, you get to a point where it's just fruitless, and you can't feel like you can't do anything. If I had a clear mind then, I guess, maybe I could... something would have been different. It's traumatizing. I mean, it changed me. It changed my entire being.
That brings us to the end of episode 163. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for the show. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to contact me, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Join me next time. I'll be covering a case from New York. Thanks for listening.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.